As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Van Riper here, along with Keith Law. It is Friday, June 25th. Got a great show lined up for today. Wander Franco came up this week. We'll talk about his debut and go through a few different exercises with him, including where he might go if we were redrafting the entire player universe from scratch. The Tigers brought up Matt Manning since Keith and I last spoke, so we'll talk about expectations for him, as well as the rest of the Tigers' young rotation members. They may have another really interesting young starter on the way as a result of a possible pairing from Keith's latest mock drafts. We'll dig into that a bit. And we'll take a look at a few prospects that should be next to get the call now that we've really moved past the point where Super 2 considerations are on the minds of teams as they think about promoting their best prospects. Keith, let's start with Wander. He, of course, has to be the main story for this week. And I thought they had a path to justify calling him up as soon as they had the extra year of service time preserved back in April. They opted to give him a few months at AAA. He didn't really have any issues there whatsoever. And now he joins an offense that's been league average to this point in terms of WRC+, but second in the majors in strikeout rate as a team behind only the Tigers. So Wander really kind of fits a need in Tampa Bay's offense in that he's a guy that shouldn't strike out a lot, even as he's finding his way as a big league hitter. How high can we set the bar for expectations for this guy? And you know, what do you think we get from him for the rest of 2021?
Yeah, and I don't want to set the bar too high for any player who gets called up. And I mean, you can start with Jared Kelenic, right? He was one of the top prospects in baseball. Everybody agreed. I think I had him, what, fourth coming into the season. He hit well in AAA and he comes up and he's not good. And I still think Jared Kelenic is going to have a great career. I'm not worried about him. But, hey, the major leagues are really hard. And trying to predict what these kids are going to do in a very short period of time is kind of difficult. And so I don't want to put – not that I think it's going to be pressure, high expectations. Obviously, Wander had a great debut, which was awesome. Loved watching his father celebrate when he hit his home run. But at the same time, you know, maybe Wander won't be super productive right out of the gate, even though – I think it's pretty much unanimous that he's going to be a star going forward. I do think there are two things to focus on. One, as you mentioned, he's a high contact hitter. He's always been a high contact hitter. And if you've seen his swing and you've seen his plate discipline, just watching Tuesday night, you could see he had some pretty good takes, I thought, on pitches off the outside corner. Eduardo Rodriguez kept trying to backdoor him with breaking stuff or with changeups, and Franco just laid off, which was a good sign. And the fact that his hand acceleration is so fast, I think he's going to put a lot of balls in play. Now, do they all fall in for hits? Okay, we don't know. But he's going to put the ball in play more. And if the Rays wanted to address that, he's the best internal candidate they could possibly have for that. Also, I pointed out in our news brief on his call-up, They really haven't gotten any production out of second base from Brandon Lau. Shortstop has not been good for them, although Taylor Walls at least provides better defense. He's been getting on base at a good clip. Joey Wendell, after a really good start, he went through a couple of weeks where he wasn't as good, where he kind of looked like Joey Wendell again. And then he had a week where he was better again. Joey Wendell's fine, but he's not a star. So moving Franco around from those three positions, but maybe especially focusing on second base, just makes them better, even if he's only okay. And like I said, I think that's probably a reasonable expectation that he just comes up and he's maybe league average or something, even though I think he's going to be a superstar.
Being league average when you debut is successful, as we've said before. And I think the projections for Wander are very encouraging, like much better than what we saw even from the Jared Kelnick projection a few weeks ago. Looking at the same system we used then, the bat, a system that Derek Cardi built, you could see it publicly facing over at Fangraphs. Wander is projected for the rest of the season to hit 280 with a 336 OBP and a 445 slugging percentage. That's 18% better than a league average hitter if he actually hits that projection. And projections are usually very conservative on the whole with players that have no major league experience.
There's been a, you know, Saris and I think, you know, ended up writing a little bit about this. And we're talking about this on Slack. We've had issues with projection systems on these extreme outlier players being way too optimistic. Remember the Vlad projections from a couple of years ago where he was supposed to be a 5-WAR player in his rookie year? And I had him ranked as the second best prospect in baseball. So obviously I liked the guy. And even at the time, I was saying that seems really optimistic. I remember Matt Wieters when he was a prospect. Obviously projection systems are a little different now, but still it was the same thing. Just because he destroyed the minors, the projection systems all assumed he was going to be basically an MVP candidate, a top 10 hitter in his league in his rookie season. And Wieters never got there. Now Vlad is getting there now, and that's great. But I can't look. I just do not take projection systems seriously on players with no major league experience. I just don't. I think they've missed too many times on the elite prospect, which is not to say scouts don't miss. We all miss. However, what happens, I find, with the projection systems, because those are numbers, people anchor on them. People just assume, oh, no, that's what he's going to be. What are you talking about? Those are the numbers. The computer said that's what he's going to be. And they just can't, I think they especially can't handle outlier players. And I understand why. I understand enough of making projections of how, you know, some of these are using machine learning techniques. I know how those are built. Of course they're not. There are not a lot of good comparisons for players like Wander Franco, who went through the minors and looked like Wander Franco statistically, and maybe some of the physical characteristics they try to build in. Basically nobody. Very, very few guys, if at all. So you have such a small sample to build off of that I hope he's a superstar right out of the gate, but I know that's not usually how the world works. And I keep coming back to Mike Trout, first 125 at-bats in the big, or plate appearances in the big leagues, wasn't actually that good. And he got sent down, and it wasn't the worst decision in the world. And then by the time he came back next May or June, he was the best player in baseball, maybe the best in the history of the game. So Franco could, even if he does struggle a little bit this year, I still think Franco is going to be a superstar eventually. I just can't tell you when, and I don't think a projection system can tell you that either.
Right, and I think for me, it's just the realization that even a great projection system is limited with the information it can account for with minor league players. There's so much noise in minor league production that also makes it a problem to kind of figure out what that entry level point is going to be. And if you were just totally anti-projection, you'd look at it and say, oh, well, Acuna and Tatis and Soto came up and they destroyed their projections. Well, it goes both ways. It is exactly the most difficult type of player to project. The second most difficult player to project, I think, is the player that comes up and struggles, right? The Jared Kelnick 2022 projection is going to be hard. The Gavin Lux 2021 projection was difficult. Kyle Tucker came up a couple years ago, struggled initially. His projections were awful for his next full season. And if you look at them, you'd say, this doesn't make sense. Like, if you see a guy that hit 30 homers and stole 20 bases as a 21-year-old at AAA, he's probably not going to hit 220 with a 290 OBP and slug 380 in a full season against big league pitching. He's probably better than that. Like, there's just, again, this is not at all criticizing projections. It's trying to understand the limitations and make better decisions as a result of understanding how the sausage is made, so to speak.
Yeah, I think there are certain classes of players that are just going to be tougher for projection systems and are, I think, help make the argument for teams like the Rays, like the Dodgers, that do it essentially both ways, that they use analytics and that they also have, I mean, to both those clubs have maintained their traditional scouting staffs, and they make sure that the two sides really work together, but they have not decided, you know, the way that we're seeing Cleveland do now and that Baltimore and Houston and Milwaukee have done before. This is, we don't really need scouts. We can just do all of this from the office, essentially. Where, you know, there are players such as pitchers who rack up really good strikeout rates in the minors despite maybe not having particularly great stuff, or maybe who's, you know, specifically I can think of guys whose fastballs are kind of light. Matt Boyd is a good example of this, who's had to really change at all to become anything more than a up and down guy in the big leagues, where he got through the minors with a pretty straight, very homer prone fastball, but because he threw strikes and he had decent secondary stuff, he could get a lot of strikeouts, especially in the low minors. And the projection systems are just going to see that. They don't really factor in enough about how the pitchers are getting to those results. That information is obviously getting better, certainly better than it was 5 or 10 years ago, but it's still going to miss something. And those guys will tend to be excessively favored by projection systems. There's always going to be categories of players that those systems have a hard time with, because what they're trying to do is find comparable examples. Whatever method you use to build those, all machine learning techniques essentially try to say, okay, if the last 5, 10, 15, 20 players who had similar general characteristics to this one, then I'm going to put this guy into that bucket and project his future to look somewhat like the aggregate futures of those players to whom he is most comparable. That's how you build a projection system. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's of course going to miss on players. And if you want to increase your the accuracy of your projection system, you should marry it with other information that could pull out certain guys and say, no, this one is more likely to be successful. Wander Franco maybe is more likely to be successful because of his bat speed, because of his exceptional strike zone recognition. Hey, maybe just because he's a middle infielder who really is going to stay in the middle infield. Things that a pure projection system without that kind of human input is not going to adequately reflect.
So you've mentioned the bat speed a couple of times. As far as other young players, other prospects you've seen over the years, who else sort of fits into the conversation as having comparably great bat speed upon arrival? Like, just to give us some visuals, because I think for a non-scout especially, maybe it's one of those things like a really fast player, an 80 runner. We can all see an 80 runner and go, that guy's fast. Maybe it's that kind of bat speed, but what other prospects sort of fit that mold as they came up?
The bat speed kings for me, I always go back to the Upton brothers, and Justin especially, had such great bat speed, such fast, that acceleration from 0 to 60, so to speak, where, and it, with Wander, it's very true. If you saw video, especially from the side of his home run the other night, it reminded me when I first saw him in the Appalachian League, maybe 3 years ago now, and I just, the video, I tweeted it, the tweet's not up anymore, but I tweeted it, and you could hear at the very end me starting to laugh, because I just couldn't get over how his hands went from what looked like dead still to max speed, and he just launched a home run off of a fastball in Pulaski. That's not even a minor league team anymore. And you just, it's rare to see guys who can do that, and even more rare than to marry that kind of bats, because every once in a while I'll see a novelty guy who just, he's got a really fast bat, but he can't hit, can't convert that into actual production. But Franco has an idea of the strike zone and recognizes pitches. And despite great bat speed, it's pretty controlled. Right? He's not flailing. I think Gary Sheffield, for folks who remember him, he's always one of the paragons when it comes to discussing bat speed. And Sheffield should have struck out more given how his mechanics worked. But I also always point to Sheffield and say, you'd never actually teach anyone to hit like that. Right? Worked for him. And if folks tried to change him, I know Sheffield went through a lot where he was with the Brewers, right? And they just couldn't figure out what to do with him. But, you know, the huge bat wag and starting his hands that high, that would not work for 99.9% of hitters. His hands were so fast, he managed to get around it. For most guys, even if their hands are that fast, you would want them to start kind of like Franco does. It's pretty quiet. And that's what makes it even funnier to me in a good way to watch, where it's like, da-da-da-da-da-da, boom. And you just think, wait, what? Did someone just flick a switch and someone just turned the Franco machine on? But that's what it looks like. It's just he goes from nothing to maximum speed in what seems like an impossibly short amount of time.
So we're looking at this player that has superstar ceiling, and it's a question of how quickly he gets there. But if we were redrafting everybody in the player universe from scratch today, where would Wander go in that draft?
Yeah, pretty high because of his youth. Especially if we're factoring in contract status and salary, right? This guy is, if Major League Baseball, the Supreme Court, after their great ruling on the NCAA the other day, maybe they come in to say to Major League Baseball, all right, everybody out of the pool. This whole thing's an antitrust violation, and we gotta redraft all the players tomorrow. But all the rules of the CBA are still in place and player service time is still intact. I mean, that's, I'm sort of stating the assumptions of the exercise. I think he's one of the top 10 players picked because everyone believes he's going to be a superstar. He is major league ready. And he's only 20. You get him for the next 6 years. For the next 3.5 years, you're paying him essentially nothing. Nice money for him, but also they're basically not required to pay him anything more than the minimum. You can't pay him. You're going to have to pay somebody that money anyway. You're not allowed to field a team. So he is one of the best values in all of baseball. That factors in some of the rules right now that kind of exploit the youngest players. The salary structure in baseball has not changed to reflect the fact that we have position players, especially getting to the majors quite young and being productive right out of the chute to a level that I don't think we've really seen previously. Acuna, Tatis, now you could add Vlad Jr. to that. Soto, these guys are coming to the majors really fast and getting there, especially though these are all players signed out of Latin America. They sign at 16, they're in the majors at 19 or 20. And they're still productive right away. And if you believe that's what Franco is going to be, then yes, he should be paid, valued accordingly if you did this sort of overall redraft of everybody in organized baseball.
Yeah, I think if you consider the long-term defensive ability on top of the elite bat, does he stick on the left side of the infield for the bulk of that time, or does he eventually move to a corner outfield spot?
To me, he's a permanent middle infielder. I think he's a middle infielder his whole career. I would say it's 60-40 for me, maybe 55-45 second base, meaning over the next, I don't know, say that he plays a 15-year career. That actually feels short given how young he is, but he has a long career. At what position do I think he plays the most games? Second base. Also, then on top of that, I'm saying that independent of who he plays for. I think the Rays, if Taylor Walls continues to get on base at a pretty good clip, he might end up becoming their near-term shortstop because he's a better defender. Franco can play shortstop. He is not an elite defender there. Walls is probably at least a 60 defender. He's got a chance to be more. I'd like to see him more, too. And the Rays people have said for years that he was the best defensive shortstop they had in the system, especially once Lucius Fox was traded. Then there wasn't really any question. And they may just say, you know what, Walls can just get on base and play great defense. Fine. We'll put Franco at second. That leaves Brandon Lau probably in a bench spot or on the outs. But you can't argue with them giving an everyday job anywhere to Franco.
Yeah, Lau is a nice player for sure. I mean, what he was doing in the shortened season last year, it was above my expectations. And I knew he was likely to come back down to, I don't know, a more sustainable level. At the same time, I didn't see a league average bat either. I kind of saw more of like 2019 on a per game basis as his baseline.
Yeah.
125 WRC plus that year. He makes a lot of hard contact. So he's the kind of guy that gets away with a high K rate because when he puts a ball in play, it's more likely to be a hit. Power's legit. And he's going to play a lot in the outfield, I think, as a result of Wander coming up. And things are going to get more crowded in Tampa Bay probably at some point later on this summer. We'll get to a few of those players in a little bit.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's talk about Matt Manning for a moment, Keith. He got a little overshadowed by Wander's arrival, but the Tigers have their big three all in their rotation together. We've seen a couple of turns for Manning, got his first big league win earlier this week. What's your overall assessment of Manning? Because to me, the big flaw we saw from him at AAA earlier this year was a home run rate that looked like an ERA. Home run rate was over 3/9. Didn't really think that was going to be part of his profile coming through the lower levels. So how much success do you think he can have as he tries to figure it out against big league hitters?
Yeah, he shouldn't be up. And I think what you've seen in two starts is he shouldn't be up. Certainly from AAA, he was never going to get called up, except that I don't think they had anybody else. I'm pretty sure they were in a situation where they had nobody else to recall, and they just needed a starter. He's struck out four guys in two starts. His stuff has been, I think, a little less than what we anticipated from him. And he's also been extremely fastball heavy, which is a little concern because when I've seen him in the minors, now going back 2 years now and spoken to others too, he was more of a more complete three pitch arsenal. He'd really improved the breaking ball since high school when he really just didn't have a good one. It was very, very kind of mechanical delivery, very sort of stiff for a guy who was 6'6 or so and very athletic. For folks who don't know, he actually had a two-sport scholarship, baseball and basketball, to go to Loyola Marymount when the Tigers took him and signed him as the ninth pick in the draft. You know, now it's all fastball. His fastball's not really very – it's not deceptive. It is – there's some good extension, but not a lot of spin, not a lot of movement, and he's not missing bats with it. And hitters are, so far, they're getting to the fastball, so he's not even getting to his breaking ball or to his changeup. And right now, with everything looking from him like it's just a tick down from where I had remembered it, say, a couple years ago, and he did have a little shoulder thing last year. It wasn't supposed to be serious, but that was the reason we didn't see him. We saw Mize and Scuba last year, but not Manning. It makes me wonder if he's just 95%, not 100%. And that's why all his stuff seems to be a little worse than what it was pre-pandemic. You know, I hope it's nothing, but I also look at the two starts so far at the stuff and at the results. And I think he's not a major league starter right now. Something has to change. The stuff has to improve. Maybe he has to change his approach a little bit, or maybe he ends up going back to AAA for a little while to try to recover that last, I don't know, half grade or so of stuff, of quality to those pitches.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how aggressive the Tigers are if he struggles, if they're going to let him stay, because they let Casey Mize and Tarek Skubal stay when they struggled upon arrival last year. But I think the level of dominance we saw from both of those guys as they moved through the minors was such that you didn't really have a justification for sending them back down, especially when it was the alternate site and not actually, you know, time at AAA for those guys last year. And maybe that decision is paid off, because if you look at how both Mize and Skubal have been performing throughout this season, Mize has been pretty good really all year. Both have been great lately. Casey Mize, going back about 5 or 6 weeks now, has an ERA in the low threes, a 39-8 strikeout to walk ratio in his last 43 and two-thirds innings. 8 homers during that span, so a little bit of a home run problem, but you know, that's definitely a guy making the move towards being a front rotation sort of pitcher. And even Skubal, who was getting blasted earlier this season, was giving up more hard contact than anybody in the league. Yeah, like he was a disaster when we talked about him last. He's cut home runs down a lot. 5 homers and 37 and two-thirds, 54-16 strikeout to walk in his last 37 and two-thirds. I mean, that's a good turnaround for a guy that looked a little bit lost just 6 weeks ago.
It's funny you mentioned on Mize, too. The one thing I found interesting, obviously, I loved Mize in college. I thought he was the best prospect in his draft class. Always been very high on him. But one of the many reasons I was high on him was that he had an outpitch in his splitter. And he's actually not using the splitter that much. He's still using it. I would say hasn't put it away exactly, but he's been much more fastball slider so far. And it also makes me look at him. I don't know if the Tigers have told him not to use it as much, and I'm not sure what the reason is, but could there even be another gear in there? Was it a, hey, you got to learn to establish your fastball, pitch off that. He always had a good slider. I would have argued in college his slider and his splitter were both better than the fastball, both more likely to miss bats once he got into pro ball. And then, hey, once you really establish yourself and you know those two pitches are working, you're comfortable, we can work the splitter in even a little bit more, because I thought it was pretty good. And I'm a big fan of the splitter in general. And the fewer people who throw it we see in the majors, the more I want to see guys throw it, because hitters don't see it. And it should be a more effective, more deceptive pitch if they're just not used to seeing it. So it does make me think there might be another gear in Mize above what we've seen so far this year.
Yeah, of those secondaries, the slider is the one that he's been leaning on most heavily. Definitely a surprise compared to what many of us expected when they drafted him a couple of years ago. But it is weird. I mean, establishing the fastball, that to me feels like an outdated concept. I mean,
you think a lot of teams, still, yeah.
But is it still something that there are teams that pushing young guys to do? Because if your fastball is your worst pitch, and I spend a lot of time looking at some of the Stuff Plus metrics that Eno Saris and Max Bay have worked on, I see so many player cards where the fastball, whether it's the four-seamer or the sinker, it's clearly a guy's worst pitch, and yet teams have him throwing it more than anything. And it's particularly frustrating when you have a deep arsenal, which Mize does, where you've got three secondaries you can throw. And if you can command even two of those secondary pitches, you should have a more balanced pitch mix. It seems like that would just keep hitters off balance, not throwing a fastball 50%+ of the time.
Well, you've seen a lot of teams go away from that, not just individual pitchers, but I think it's team by team. And my sense is that the Tigers are not one of those teams. They still do have guys work pretty heavily with the fastball, and that's been certainly specifically been true of Mize, where he throws his four-seamer more than anything else. I think his four-seamer and StatCast categorizes him as having a four-seamer and a sinker. But if you add those together, I believe that's a majority of the pitches he's thrown this year. So that's clearly his approach. Now, he can dot with the fastball pretty effectively, so that's good. Would he be better if he replaced some fraction of those fastballs with splitters, especially once he's ahead in the count? Maybe. I think so, because of what I remember the splitter being in the past. And because I think the Tigers are still, they're a bit of a traditional organization in a lot of ways. And I think that they are one of those clubs that still does think about fastball first, and your secondary pitches are secondary. They come second. That's why we call them secondaries.
So thinking about the young starters right now, I think Mize, Skubal, Manning is the way that I would at least rank their present value, how much I trust those guys to go out and pitch well on any given day, right? There's a clear drop, I think, from Skubal to Manning, at least for the time being.
For now.
What's interesting, though, is that you have a new mock draft up that went up on The Athletic on Thursday. Jack Leiter could fall to the Tigers with that third pick. And you think about Leiter joining those three guys, that's pretty enticing because you know, for the Tigers, like, there's still some things they're missing in terms of position player talent. But if you have those four guys healthy atop the rotation, this rebuild might not be as far away from being completed. I think you can find relative bargains in position players in free agency, and sometimes even via trade, you can buy low on some guys. But it seems like pitching is the hardest thing to go get right now, and they might have four pretty high-quality big league starters if they can fix Manning and if they end up with Leiter at three.
Well, yeah, so the argument that I had, and the Tigers were heavy on Leiter at his super regional. So this was not just pure speculation, but they were clearly considering him. You're not going to see a guy like that heavily at this date unless he's in your decision set. And he should be. The Tigers pick third. And there's a very good chance Leiter's going to be there for them. So, you know, the Tigers I had previously only heard linked to two high school players. Marcelo Mayer, high school shortstop, who in the mock today I had going first. And then Jackson Jobe, a high school right-hander from Oklahoma, who we haven't had a high school pitcher go in the top 10 in the last 2 years. And Jobe is the best high school pitcher in this year's draft class. But one, I've talked about this a bunch here on my own show, my book, in the Inside Game, my second book, that high school pitchers in the first round are a pretty terrible risk. And if you pick third, that's a really huge risk. I don't care how good you think Jobe is, and people think he's really good. That's a pretty huge risk to take. But on top of that, if you were the Tigers, you have the three pitchers you just mentioned who are now in the big leagues. Whether Manning should be there in AAA, whatever. He's in the big leagues. Then at AAA, you have your top three prospects still in the minors. Spencer Torkelson, last year's number one pick, is there. Riley Green, Tigers first rounder from 2 years ago, already there. He's been amazing. Dylan Dingler, catcher, their second rounder from last year, for all the world looks like he should have been a first rounder. And there were just some questions about he'd had some injuries in college. I think it's the main reason he wasn't a first rounder last year, but he probably should have been. Those three guys are in Double A. They're going to be there real quick. Would not shock me at all if one of them at least made their major league debuts this year. They're certainly all going to be up next year. So do you want to take Jackson Jobe, even if you think he's the best high school pitcher in the country, even if he does stay healthy, which a lot of high school pitchers, doesn't matter how good they are, they have a hard time staying healthy. He's not going to be in the big leagues for 4 or 5 years. Maybe Mayer is 3 or 4 years away. Leiter is probably less than 2 years away from the majors. So if you're trying to time this right, say, hey, we pick third, we got a chance to get a guy who can go into our rotation in a year, year and a half, you should at least seriously consider it. It shouldn't be the only consideration. It's not the only input, but it should be one of them.
And it's this vision where you feel like you can make a lot of progress pretty quickly. I mean, look how top heavy it is right now. The White Sox have had so many things go wrong, and it just feels like they're in the driver's seat. Cleveland's still obviously hanging around. The Twins have had a bad year. We talked about them a few weeks ago. But just in terms of long-term talent as well, I think the Tigers could very easily be contenders maybe by 2023. Again, mm-hmm. It's going to require health for these starting pitchers and the continued development of that core group of position guys that you mentioned. But the floors on Torkelson and Green and Dingler all look pretty good as well. And you're going to add more talent between now and the time that those guys are all up together.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with everything you just said. And I, as much as folks are and should be excited about these Tigers arms, that trio of bats in Erie right now, that's a hell of a core right there. And there's a chance all three of those guys are offensive stars for their positions. I probably feel best about Green overall. But I will say Dylan Dingler can really hit for a catcher. And at a position where most teams aren't getting a whole lot of offense, the Tigers have had trouble trying to fill that spot. That's going to give them a pretty huge leg up competitively, having that kind of bat potentially at that position behind the plate. You're going to build a lineup around those three guys soon. So it's not the whole team. That's not a whole contender, but those three guys in the lineup, those two, possibly three guys in the rotation, it's a pretty good start, at least, towards building a real contender, as you said, in a division where there's opportunity. Why wouldn't you consider, if you're not overdrafting a guy, you're not reaching to take Jack Leiter at three, why wouldn't you consider him? This is not like they're taking the 15th best player in the draft at three. They're taking a guy who is one of the three or four best players in the draft and taking him at three.
Yeah, 2 months ago, a guy that would have gone 1-1 for
most people. Yeah, he might have been gone. Well, I think that's the other thing. That's probably why they were there. Right, everyone's had to scramble a little bit because for a while it was Rocker's going one or two. Oh, no, wait, now he's slipping. Okay, wait, no, now Leiter's going one. Oh, no, wait, now he's slipping. Wait, now it's Davis. Well, he's not really slipping, but the teams up top might prefer to take the high school players. And now Henry Davis might drop a little bit. And, he could – Henry Davis could end up going four. He could end up going five, six. Well, probably not five, but he could go six. It's extremely uncertain at the top, and that's before you even throw in – the money angle. We're in baseball, for I assume listeners know, but slot values in baseball are not fixed. They are recommendations, and teams can go over, go under. They have an overall draft pool, a budget for the top 10 rounds to which they have to adhere or face large penalties. But it's possible, I said this in the mock draft, the Orioles last year picked second, but they took a player who was not the second best player in the draft because they could cut him. They could get a pretty substantial discount on his bonus, and then overspend to get high school talent later in the draft. Most folks I've asked expect them to do the same thing. Will they do the same thing if one of the, if Jack Leiter is there at five, if Jordan Lawler should happen to be there at five? I don't know, but that is a pretty significant and I would say probable way that we could see the very top of the draft end up sort of blowing up and changing a lot of teams' plans where they have to be prepared for scenarios that a month or two ago looked very unlikely.
Yeah, I think that's something where teams are probably more nimble than a lot of people realize, that if the right guy is there, they go down mm-hmm. path A. If that guy's not there, path B is the way to go. And I think the Orioles might have a few different path A options that they didn't expect to be there 2 months ago that absolutely mm-hmm. could be there and really change their plans.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary. Keith, let's take a look at some prospects who could be next because we've cleared the Super 2 concern window. Jaren Duran is really putting a lot of questions about his power to rest at AAA. We know that was something that really surfaced for the first time at the alternate site last year, and I think many people said, great, let's go. Let's see you do it in games consistently. And he has. He's got power. He's got speed. The K rate's up a little, but for the amount of power he's added compared to what he was doing at the lower levels, I think you'll pretty happily accept that. And he fits on this roster. He could pretty easily take over as the primary center fielder in a good Boston lineup without the pressure of being a guy that has to do a ton from the jump. So do you think it's a matter of days, weeks before we see Jaren Duran claiming a spot in Boston?
I thought he was going to come up a couple of weeks ago. I'm not really sure if they're holding him down. I mean, he's 24. He'll be 25 in September. Now, I understand ages are a little off from normal, from our norms because of the pandemic, but there's not really a good argument for him to still be in AAA. He's destroyed it when he's been playing. He's hitting for power. He's getting on base at a good clip. My understanding is his defense has been really good. He's been, my God, he's had only three games in June where he didn't get a hit, only two where he didn't fail to get on base so far in the entire month. He's one, two, three, four, five, six games in a row where he's had at least one hit. It's not even, oh, well, he just got off to a hot start and he's not holding it. He's just kind of doing everything. And I like I said, I actually am a little flummoxed because I thought he'd be in the big leagues by now. And the Red Sox people were so excited about the swing change and what they saw in the alternate site and what they saw in spring training this year. And, this is real. It's absolutely going to carry over. Great. Let's have him go out, go to AAA, and let's see it. And then it hasn't. He hasn't faltered. He has done exactly what we wanted him to do, what the Red Sox wanted him to do. And it's not like they're getting a ton of offense from Kike Hernandez, who's a really nice bench player, but he's taken a lot of reps for them in center field. And you'd certainly like to do better than that. And they have a guy right there who can do better than that. So I don't know. He should have been up yesterday. You said, is it days, weeks, months? I'd like to say it's days because that's the rational answer. I don't know what their logic is for holding him down.
You know, it's also, this is the other thing that's really bothered me lately. It seems like teams actually want their young prospects to debut at home. Like they'll wait an extra few days, even when it's not even a service time question anymore, to let that player come up and play in front of the home crowd for his debut, which, I mean, that's a great fan experience, but every single game is going to matter in the AL East. I think that's pretty clear now. I think it was pretty clear even when the season began, that if the Red Sox were going to win the division, they weren't going to do it in a landslide because there were at least three teams that were going to chase them. They have a home series this weekend against the Yankees. Do they not debut him in that series because it's a rivalry series and too much pressure? I mean, that seems kind of ridiculous to me. Do they wait until Monday for the home series that starts against the Royals? I think you're exactly right. I think this should have been a call-up maybe even a month ago. So any day seems appropriate at this point, but how much do those kinds of factors actually play into the decision of when specifically to bring that guy up for the first time?
I mean, they're not supposed to. Do teams do that? Sure. I mean, of course you want Wander Franco to debut when you're at home, especially if you're the Rays, where the you could you get more, does your gate increase because of that? Okay, sure. But the number one consideration, well, I'd say the top two considerations should be, is the player ready and do we need him?
Yeah.
And in this case, the player's ready. Red Sox could use him. That's it, right? I don't think there's anything more after that.
Yeah, I don't think if he's big league ready, when he sees the Yankees for the first time does not matter. Like it's big league pitching regardless of whether he debuts then or against the Royals or whoever they decide to call him up against. So he should be among the very first players we're talking about to get the big league opportunity. I think the rest of this group's a little more difficult to figure out for reasons out of their control. Bobby Witt Jr. is starting to crush the ball at AA after a slow start. And I think one of our first episodes that we did back in late March was, is he actually going to make the opening day roster? And of course, that didn't happen. The slow start kind of put everyone's minds at ease. Okay, yeah, this wasn't as close to happening as maybe we thought. But he's tearing up AA now. The problem here is that the Royals aren't going anywhere in 2021. It's kind of like the Adley Rutschman problem in Baltimore. You can look at the AA numbers and say, that guy's probably ready to play in the big leagues. If you're thinking about the long-term value for the team, it seems less likely to happen.
Yeah, they got it. What they need to do in his case first is, you know, Witt got off, he did get off to a pretty rough start. And once he got, it looks like he got around the league a little bit and he's made some adjustments, which is great, obviously, when he's facing an opponent the second time and he's showing that adjustment. The next challenge should be bump him up to AAA. And, you know, I hope that this has kind of sobered them and frankly a lot of people up that, you know, there was call Witt's going to make the team out of spring training. And you just obviously, you talked about that. We've talked about that. Send him to AAA and expect that he might struggle again for a couple of weeks and have to make those adjustments again. If you see him making those adjustments, he spends July in AAA. And then if he doesn't do well, but in August he starts to make those adjustments, great. He's right on schedule. It's exactly what we're hoping for. And then maybe you think, well, maybe we call him up a little bit in September and let him, obviously it means adding him to the 40 man. There are all kinds of business considerations there. But from a baseball perspective, certainly in the olden days, back in my day, we would call everybody up in September. Now they're not even allowed to, obviously, but could he be one of your call-ups if you're the Royals? Because you're saying, hey, every time we've moved him up, I'm really speculating out a couple steps here, but called him up, moved him right into AA, scuffled it a little bit, but then he got better. Move him to AAA. Say that pattern repeats itself. Would you call him up to the majors in September? Certainly the fans would be excited. You'd probably get some more attendance. And hey, if he struggles, that's fine. He makes the adjustment. He comes back next year. He's ready to be the opening day shortstop. I would at least think of that as a plan. First step is to send him to AAA and see what happens.
And I think there's a pretty clear distinction here too, because you're talking about a guy who's still just 21 years old. Witt just turned 21 10 days ago.
Yeah.
So the urgency is not there quite the same way as it would be for someone who played in college, and Josh Jung in Texas, also a team not going anywhere this year. I think it makes more sense to go ahead and bring him up as soon as you think he's ready. He had that foot injury. He's back from that, playing at AA right now. He turned 23 back in February. If you decide he's ready after the All-Star break or August 1st or September 1st or whenever that ends up being, I think you are much more likely with that type of player to give him that first taste of the big leagues at some point in the second half of the season.
Yeah, I think Jung is kind of the archetype of the college player who would typically by now have had, say, a full year's worth of experience in A-ball and then starts this year in AA. And then you're basically saying, okay, at some point he's already ready to springboard from there to the big leagues. There could be a stop in AAA. You think it's less important for a college player on his particular career path. Now, obviously, he missed last year. He doesn't have the full season in A-ball. He only spent 40 games in A-ball 2 years ago after he was drafted, which in hindsight looks like a great decision by the Rangers to just push him there. Since he missed all of last year, now he's only got 7 games in AA so far, and he's off to a good start. Great. I would really like to see him spend 2 months, get him 50-ish games down there. Maybe have him face an opponent more than once, which this new schedule, the way they do the minor league schedules now, is not helping matters. I actually think it's going to hurt development because you're not facing some opponents multiple times in a shorter period. And therefore the pitchers, okay, well this time, you know, last time Jung got me on a breaking ball away, so I'm going to pitch him differently this time. You don't get that pattern. the pattern of players making adjustments to each other that I think is a crucial part of player development, you might lose that. So all the more reason maybe to have Young spend a little more time at Double A, especially since he just hasn't played that much since he was drafted. And then you can always call him straight up from Double A too. I think it's much less important for a player of his age and his experience as a college guy to get that Triple A experience before he comes up.
Yeah, it's a really good point about the minor league schedule that I hadn't thought about. I thought the benefits of not traveling as frequently were a big pro, but the adjustment phase, that's such a difficult part of becoming a big leaguer, and but the big league schedule still being more like a normal big league schedule, that's a test that you don't replicate as easily running the minor league schedule the way it's being run right now. You know, we started the conversation today with the Rays. We'll sort of end the player-related conversation with the Rays. Vidal Brujan probably belongs on this list. We've talked about him a lot on this pod. He has cooled off a little after a red-hot start to the season. And then there's Josh Lowe, also in the organization, putting up big numbers at AAA. We haven't talked as much about Lowe. I'm curious, do you see him fitting with the Rays, or do you see him as one of their most tradable, big-league-ready type players that they can flip to get upgrades on this roster that might be a little more proven?
I'm a big Lowe fan. I know the Rays are too. I think he's got a chance to be an above average regular on both sides of the ball for a long time. You know, I think one of their bigger problems is that they committed a while ago to Kevin Kiermaier, and he's just not very good anymore. He's got 284 on base, looking like their most played outfielders so far, most used outfielders. Kiermaier at 284 on base. Manuel Margot, who is a center fielder by trade, at 285 on base. You know, I liked Margot as a prospect. It's just not happening. It's just never happening, clearly. He has not been able to convert the solid contact rates into enough quality contact, and it's probably time to turn the page. Probably time to turn the page on both of those guys, actually. And I think they'd be more likely to get – they'll lose a little bit on defense maybe with Lowe, but Lowe's a very good defensive center fielder. But you'll get some thump. I think you'll get more total offense out of him, and I do think he is their long-term center fielder. So the only question is, do you call him up and maybe take the risk that he has a Jared Kelenic-type debut, and you're trying to contend right now. So you maybe – if you're Tampa Bay, you're more sensitive to that, to the possibility of a tough debut that actually costs you a game or two in the standings.
Yeah, makes that difficult decision even more difficult to make the final call on. We had a pretty funny week in baseball, to put it mildly. And it's kind of a footnote that the Padres and Dodgers had a series. The Padres swept the Dodgers. And honestly, I don't know how many people even noticed outside of fans of those two teams. Because the story of the week, Wander, obviously. But then it was also the enforcement of the sticky substance rules, right? So the images we saw most frequently scattered around Twitter, or if you watched highlight shows, Max Scherzer staring down Joe Girardi and just very angrily making his way to the dugout after being checked out by the umpires. And then Sergio Romo acting like me hurrying to catch a flight at the airport, just like trying to get everything onto the belt, into the box, through the scanner. Obviously, he was like disrobing to show, like, I don't have any sticky substances on my belt. That's what was happening if you didn't see it. I mean, that wasn't even all of what was happening off the field. And it just seems like we've hit this point again where the things that are happening around the game are getting much more attention than the things that are actually happening on the field. And it's incredibly frustrating.
It is incredibly frustrating as someone who covers baseball. And obviously, I have thoughts on the quote unquote sticky stuff. Scandal, controversy, would you call it one of those things? Obviously, you do too. I don't think either of us really ever wants to talk about it again. I'd kind of be okay just not really talking about this, but we're going to, right? Because clearly, this is not working. This has just created lots of negative attention for the sport, which appears to be one of Rob Manfred's real specialties. We could digress a little bit into the MLB tweeting, it's coming June 23rd with a big picture of a moon. And what was it? It was some cryptocurrency thing, right? I mean, are we just selling South Sea shares and tulips now?
Ugh, yeah.
What part of the baseball audience do you think you're appealing to with that? Market the game, the actual game. Just because some business no one's ever heard of offers you $20 for a sponsorship doesn't mean you have to take it. Sometimes you can just say, you know what, that's not really good for our brand. Or no, you know what, that's a distraction from what's going on in the field right now. We'll announce some big sponsorships in the offseason, but right now we are focused on a great game being played by great players. We're heading towards the All-Star break. We've got pennant races. We've got great rookies. We've got a lot going on in baseball right now. stop tweeting about cryptocurrency. I'm so over cryptocurrency as it is anyway. I'm an old man now, but I see all those things and I think that's a bubble and I don't want to be anywhere near it when it bursts. Why Major League Baseball is hitching its wagon to that particular train in June of what I think is otherwise a Major League season that's going pretty well. You know, it's almost like, well, maybe the crypto will distract us from talking about the sticky stuff some more. I guess if that was the case, good job.
Maybe that was the purpose of the very poorly designed All-Star Game uniforms that released on Thursday. I mean, those were atrocious. Like, those were one of my followers on Twitter said it seemed like they tried to go back to like the 1999 All-Star design, in which they tried to have like a really futuristic look. Like, they tried to do a throwback of the futuristic look from 20 plus years ago. And that was the only explanation of what they could have been trying to do that made sense. But you don't have to, and I realize they got to make money at every possible turn. That's part of the job if you're Rob Manfred. Keep making money, keep making money, keep making money. You don't have to use gimmicks like weird uniforms for the All-Star game. You could let the game speak for itself. If you want to introduce a new hat or a new variation of a team's actual uniform during the All-Star game, great, fine, I get that. But let the players sell the game on that day. Don't ruin it with ridiculous jerseys that I'm going to laugh at even when they're $19.99 while I go in to buy some pants at TJ Maxx.
That's not the first time, right? It's the Caps. It's the All-Star. It is. Who's, like, I just see this. And who's in charge over there right now, right? Is nobody watching this stuff go out the door? It's like MLB is a restaurant where every third plate leaves the kitchen and it's on fire. MLB needs to hire an expediter, just somebody to sit between Rob Manfred. And we always blame Manfred, but obviously it's more people than just Manfred. Sit between him and the computer and say, don't hit send on that tweet. Just let it sit for a little bit. Maybe we can talk about this some more. It's not to say that every single thing they do is bad. Like, actually, MLB's really been, for example, pushing and been public about their push to vaccinate players. That's great. I wish more players would wise up and get vaccinated. But MLB is at least doing its part. They have been trying to hold vaccine clinics at major league facilities. It's not that they're doing everything wrong, but they're doing a lot of very, very visible things wrong, and they detract from the sport. This whole sticky stuff thing is like when Sergio Romo tries to take his pants off on a field. That bleeds over into non-sports news, and it's not good. No one is going to say, ha ha, I'm going to watch more baseball now.
No, we talked about this on Rates and Barrels. Like, if the sticky stuff story reaches All Things Considered on NPR, you've done something wrong. The part of your game is hitting non-sports news shows. That's a problem.
That's a problem. That is absolutely a problem. And I don't see any sign that they recognize. Manfred's comments were sort of like, no, this is fine. This is fine. Sips coffee while house burns.
Yeah, he appears to be that dog in the coffee shop. And Keith's referring to an interview that Britt Giroli had with the commissioner earlier this week. And check that out at The Athletic. $3.99 a month gets you in the door if you don't have a subscription. You can check out all the Keith stuff, too. We got the new mock that we talked about a little bit earlier and a piece that went up earlier in the week looking at high draft picks and whether or not they've been on faster timetables to the big leagues in recent years. So lots of good stuff there. And all over the site. You can also check out Keith's latest episode of The Keith Law Show. His guest this week was Dr. Elizabeth Hinton, and the conversation focuses on the topics of Dr. Hinton's latest book, America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. You can hear me on the aforementioned Rates and Barrels podcast and on the Fantasy Baseball shows as well. If you're enjoying the show, take a moment to leave us a nice rating and review, and tell a friend if you got a friend that would like it as well. On Twitter, he's at Keith Law. I'm at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show is back on Monday. Enjoy the baseball and have a great weekend.